You're tuned to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, a Massachusetts judge heard arguments over the November 1st suspension of food aid known as SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Hawaii is one of several states that is asking for an emergency restraining order to block the action. In the meantime, Hawaii is moving forward with two different relief programs to fill in the gap. We spoke to Governor Josh Green earlier this morning about what those relief programs will look like, as well as his recent visit to the nation's capital and ongoing discussions with the military over its expiring land leases.
So there's at least two very significant programs that we're doing. The first one is our Hawaii Relief Program, and that is an authorization. I'm going to do it through executive order today, where we're authorizing $100 million in TANF money. That's temporary assistance for needy families. That'll pay up to 4 months of housing and utility assistance for families with children who are facing hardship. And essentially, any family that is up to 300% of the federal poverty limit and has a kid, we will help cover their mortgage or their rent for 4 months and their utilities to get them through the hard times. So that's one huge program. Families will be eligible for tens of thousands of dollars to get through this really rough time. That's the first program. And then you will hear me announce in the press conference today a $250 emergency relief payment, which is anyone who has been getting SNAP dollars will get $250 on or before November 14th. So if a family had three people on SNAP, they will get $750 into their account on or before November 14th. That will help them with food security through this month. And that will cost us about $42.2 million.
And where is this money coming from?
So a couple places. So the first $100 million is from our TANF funds. We have $400 million in there, and it's been very difficult to spend over the years. This has been going on for decades. So this is an opportunity where we really actually need the temporary assistance for families. So it's a perfect time to do that. It's not the general funds. It's a separate fund. That comes from TANF. And then the emergency relief payments, two-thirds are going to come from our general funds, and one-third is going to come from also TANF. So about $30 million, which we have enough. We do not have to today go after our special rainy day resources. We have enough monies because we're only in the second quarter, so we can help people who are really struggling. To look at this in a holistic way, between about 10 to 15% of our state is really struggling because of the federal shutdown. They're struggling even more than usual, and this will get people through this really rough time.
Well, it's admirable that we've got this, that we can step up as a safety net. But I know in the past, even with the food stamp program, we've been fined because of inaccuracies. And I know part of it is staffing, right? That we're short staffed and we've tried to hire more people. But what can you say about workers that you need in order to administer these new programs?
I have to say, I've got to give a ton of credit to our DHS team. They've been great. People have been working around the clock. Scott Morshige and our director and our deputy director have been just amazing. So everyone's been working around the clock. But we also, to get extra assistance, we have our Department of Human Services contracting with Catholic Charities Hawaii and Maui Economic Opportunity, MEO, to administer these programs. So what we will do is people will be able to call 211, also with the Aloha United Way, to get extra information. We'll try to get this information out very clearly, but it's a rough time. And there are some people that will still not qualify because for whatever reason, they don't fall into those other two categories. It will be very few people, but that will mean we need to do other things. Like we're going to give an additional $2 million to the Hawaii food banks right now. There's $500,000 for the Farm to Family program that was spearheaded by the Speaker of the House and the House Majority Caucus for locally produced food. And then finally, there's this Act 310 funding, which we passed this May, which is $50 million in grants. And they'll get those out the door sometime in later November. So it's all hands on deck. We came up with these two additional programs, the TANF program and the Emergency Relief Program, because it's just not clear that the federal government is going to make their deadlines. We don't know when they're going to lift the shutdown, whether it's the first week of November or the third week of November. It's very hard to know. I just decided it was important we pull the trigger so that no one is hungry and that no one is in a desperate circumstance and being evicted over the holidays. It has been very disruptive for months now because you have of course, some people not getting paid if they're federal workers. You have fewer people going to restaurants, which means that waiters and waitresses are making less money and they could be short on their rent. You have spouses of active military individuals, soldiers, who either are missing paychecks or not getting their full paycheck or not getting their housing allowance. And we certainly can't make them become homeless or have to go without food for their children. So I'm going to cover the gap. And I just feel that Hawaii, because we have resources, because we've been pretty cautious with our money and we've had some carryover balances, we can do this. This is a time when it's raining. And in time, when we get back to the session, if we have any shortfalls anywhere, we will humbly ask the legislature to do what they can do, which is either new appropriations or rainy day funds. But for now, we have it covered. And I've been careful always to keep my eye on the federal government because I see the dysfunction from afar. There are lots of things that I'm going to bring to Hawaii in kind of agreements with the feds over the coming couple months to years. But in this moment, we have to step up and make sure that people who are most vulnerable don't lose out and don't get victimized.
What if the judge issues a temporary restraining order? Then what happens to the safety net programs? Will those things still be administered? Will you still be accepting applications?
Yes. I'm glad you asked that question. That is the most important question. I'm going forward, period, because we could get one judicial ruling and then it could get appealed. I don't want people to be in limbo. We could see monies still slowed down administratively. The federal government might not be able to process monies even if they are ordered to go forward. So I'm simply going to make this executive decision to provide serious security for our most vulnerable people for these next couple months so that no matter what happens, perhaps the feds don't open up again until December. Perhaps they decide to open, but they don't fully implement some of the payments that have to go through. None of that is fair to people who have made plans for their children. We're also going to amp food for kids at schools. We have that also teed up so that anyone who is facing hardship can now get their kids breakfast and lunch. And we're going to do these things for the next several months until we pay down that $100 million of TANF and this full $42 million in November. I just don't want the uncertainty. I learned that as a doctor, that it's uncertainty, which is the greatest challenge for people. If they have a terrible crisis, but you can tell them with some certainty what treatment they'll need, they do better. And in this case, the same thing applies. If you give some certainty that you will have enough money for food over the holidays or for your rent, society will continue to be able to survive and even improve. If you don't, it's chaos and people really hurt.
Yes, and it's heartwarming when you see really all across the country groups that are stepping up because they don't want needy families to go hungry, particularly as we start this holiday season.
That's right. And so please, in spite of these significant resources, everyone should still be making a meal for their neighbor that's struggling a little bit more. Or if someone is pretty affluent, it's a good time to give to the Hawaii Food Bank or to the Hawaii Community Foundation. We'll probably do a food drive, Jamie and I, with our government leaders. I'm really proud of what OHA is doing for Native Hawaiians. And so kudos to Chair Kahele. That's a good thing, too. Everybody's working hard. It's a time to help each other. It happens to coincide with the holidays. 2 days from now, we're going to be in November. And you know what that means, Thanksgiving and Christmas and Hanukkah and everything right around the corner. So this is the time to help each other. And these resources are actually a boost to our economy because people will take these resources and they're going to spend the monies at the grocery stores. They'll have a little extra resource to cover what their needs are. That's all money spent here in Hawaii. So it works out very well for us. But unlocking the TANF dollars, which I'd been working on for years, we worked on that during the Maui wildfire crisis, and it was difficult to get some of those dollars out the door because they were already duplicated with federal dollars, and you're not allowed to do that. In this case, there is no duplication because it's the crisis that was created by the federal government not functioning very well. So this is, in some ways, a found opportunity to help our people.
What can you share with us about your visit to our nation's capital? You hinted that there may be some announcements to come.
That was a very focused set of 2 days. So I met with about 15 national leaders, 4 cabinet secretaries, the top of their departments, and a fifth one I'm going to see next time I have to be at the Western Governors Association. He got stuck with the president. that was Secretary of the Interior, and then many of the top military officials. So here's what people need to really know. If the federal government goes forward with this move, if the Army Secretary goes forward and decides to do the condemnation of our military base, particularly on Big Island, Paukalua, which I do not think is a great idea because it will alienate some people, but if they do that, then I'm insisting that Hawaii is cared for and that they really commit to our priorities, which are housing, energy security, basically cleaning up the ordinances, bringing lots of resources to our state, because it appears that if they invoke the concern that there's a national threat, a security threat, they are allowed to condemn lands. So if they do that, rather than going down the traditional pathway, and I recognize that they're likely to make this decision, then I'm going to demand that we have a very large package to help support us, especially the Hawaiian people, and we will do our very best to fight for our needs. I have proposed a many billion dollar package, if you will. It's well greater than $5 billion of programs that we just feel that we would need to have as a part of some kind of compromise. There are going to be people that are upset. There are certain things I can do and stop, and there's certain things I can't. So if the military makes that decision for us, and you will see that help us incredibly for the next 5 to 10 years. I also met with the Secretary of Health. You probably find that interesting. So my meeting was scheduled originally with Dr. Oz, who's the Director of Medicare and Medicaid, and Secretary Kennedy came in. We spent an hour together and talked about increasing reimbursements to the state of Hawaii by $250 million per year to balance out where we've been shorted. That will really secure our healthcare system for the indefinite future. And each meeting was like that. The Secretary of Energy is going to commit several billion dollars to this transition to fully renewable. It will include some liquid natural gas. I know that's been in people's kind of dinner table debate conversation if they're energy people, but that's our bridge to get off of Libyan oil. We get our oil from Libya, our gas and our gasoline from Libya, which is no good. It's not clean. This will help us get to a cleaner energy future over the course of 20, 25 years. And that's very important for us. So the meetings they're pretty big. I could see as much as $10 billion come to Hawaii if they make this move.
And would this be in a way a sale of land or lease of land, lease rent?
They would condemn it. They would actually do a condemnation and it would become federal land. And in exchange, we would receive over 10,000 acres, land that I would then make in large part available to the Hawaiian community through Department of Hawaiian Homelands. I'm sure they'll partner with OHA on the projects and programs. So we will come back with much more land in this process. Again, I don't love it. I'm doing what I can because the federal government has certain powers that they can use. But we'd get 10,000 plus acres back. We would likely get Makua Valley back. We would get billions of dollars to clean up unexploded ordinances and so on. And so they would then have that land. It would not be a lease question anymore. And we would have many thousands of acres back in our own control.
One final point. I understand that Time has named you on the list of influential climate leaders for this year.
Yeah, I'm very humbled by that. I was listed as one of the top 100 climate influencers. That was because of the climate impact fee. And let me dedicate this to our CAT team, our climate advisory team, and all the people at the legislature who took this leap of faith to protect our environment. Now $100 million comes to us to protect ourselves against wildfires and sea level rise and any number of other challenges. So it was very humbling to be recognized for that. I normally get attention on healthcare matters, but you could see the combination of doing relief for our people when there's a crisis, the crisis that occurred on Maui, and the healthcare concerns we've had are all the kind of things I work on. And so it was extraordinary to be noted. And the people on that list are quite something. It was neat to see. I was with, I think, the King of England and Samuel Jackson. It's funny,
yeah,
actually.
In good company.
Yeah. It was very kind of them. But really, it's for Hawaii. And this sets up our next generation. We'll be the first state that can deal with climate change for real. And that's something I'm proud of.
Well, it sounds like whether it's leases with the military or trying to make sure that our local people benefit from our visitor industry, that we've got to be able to just demand that we do better.
That's right. We have to be out ahead of the 100-foot wave or the tsunami in other circumstances. And other states have more difficulty doing it. Because of our values, however, we can actually come together. So things are going to be okay. I want people to know that.
All right. Thank you so much, Governor.
You bet. Take care.
That was Governor Josh Green, who talked to us earlier this morning about SNAP benefits, his recent trip to our nation's capital, and talks with military leaders and cabinet secretaries.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll discuss Russell Vogt, the director of the Office of Management and Budget and a key architect of Project 2025. He's been central in President Trump's dismantling of federal bureaucracy and the expansion of executive power. We'll talk with Andy Kroll, who investigated Vogt for ProPublica and The New Yorker. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters, featuring 100% Hawaiian coffees, espresso bites, subscriptions, and more. Online at BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com or at their cafe in Hilo.
The governor's news conference that we heard about at the top of the show is to take place at noon at the state capitol, and that is where HBR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo is standing by live. She joins us now. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so it will be interesting to see the details of what the governor outlined.
Yeah, you know, big announcement from, you know, Governor Green about the second program that's going to load state funds onto people's accounts by November 14th, $250 per person who is currently on SNAP. It's really interesting because over the last few days, the Department of Human Services Administrator of the Benefits Program, Scott Morishige, has been doing info briefings with lawmakers, and one of the questions has been, why not just load state funds onto people's EBT cards? Here's Morishige.
After the last government shutdown, we did work with our EBT vendor to set up the mechanics. If we had state funding identified, we could potentially use it for that. But there's a lot of other mechanics involved with our nearly 40-year-old hobby eligibility system we're using and how that sort of interfaces with everything. And then depending on the type of funding source that we're using. So it's not something that's as simple as, okay, just because this mechanism is there, that we're able to quickly stand something up.
Yeah, so
he was saying that, oh yeah, sorry.
No, it would be interesting to see, you know, how they managed to do it then.
Yeah, and that's what I thought was really interesting was because, you know, he's saying there that it's going to take too long, or he was saying it was going to take too long to respond in the moment to, you know, just like put these funds on people's EBT cards, and that they were still in conversations with the vendor. So it's not yet clear if it's going to like go direct deposit to people's accounts, be loaded onto EBT cards. And so that's what we'll be asking and listening for when the governor talks in about half an hour. You know, one of the other issues he brought up, Morishige brought up, was that once the state puts money forward for these SNAP benefits, it can't take it back if SNAP federal funds are released, and you know the federal government has made it very explicitly clear to states that they will not be reimbursed if they do this. The state attorney general joined, you know, many other states to file a lawsuit to force the president's administration to use emergency services specifically for SNAP, which is about $5 billion. And then there was a hearing this morning and the judge is deliberating, although she promised to rule soon about whether or not the federal government will actually have to release those funds. So if that comes through and the funding is restored, it's not clear what would happen to the money the governor has now committed to this project. And so I'm really curious to see what he has to say about what's changed in the last 48 hours that's making something like this possible.
So who else did you talk with?
And when, Yeah, and so I also spoke with House Finance Chair Chris Todd about, you know, how the state can respond with funds in these types of emergencies and what options the governor has, with or without the legislature.
The legislature appropriates funding, and the administration has a pretty great deal of flexibility over that money that has been appropriated. So they have the power to restrict and to spend within those, within that framework. So if they can find those solutions within that existing, you know, budget appropriation, then they would not require us to come in and convene. But if they need us to come in because they either don't have enough funding available or because the scope of what they're trying to do is so great that you would need actual language to be attached to that financing, then they'd have to bring us in.
So is he talking about like a special session?
Yeah, so what they're saying is basically that, you know, the governor is able to take money that's already been appropriated by the legislature last session in the budget and kind of move it around, and, they can restrict funding from other projects or things in other departments and redistribute those funds to address SNAP emergencies and or other emergencies, whatever they need. But if they want to touch that, the rainy day fund, which is about, you know, about $2 billion worth of state reserve, or even this thing called carryover balance, which is just extra revenue that has not been allocated anywhere, the legislature would have to come back to appropriate those funds before the governor could actually use them. And so when we're talking about redistributing these funds, it kind of raises the question of, you know, like what's being pushed aside to fund these programs. I suspect some of it will be because there's a lot of vacant, unfilled positions that have been budgeted for. So we'll see when he talks about that. One of the good examples of this restriction of funds is, you know, for example, the Department of Human Services has taken $2 million out of their budget to give to the food bank to respond to the SNAP suspension. But those funds were probably previously appropriated for other things. And so, basically what he's doing is trying to move money around within the budget to respond as quickly as possible to the emergency. One of the other things that's starting on Saturday as well is that SNAP work requirements for able-bodied adults will also go into effect, which imposes more work requirements on adults between 55 and 64, including also parents with children over 14 and youth transitioning out of foster care. AARP Hawaii Executive Director Kaylee Lopez was concerned for seniors who fall between that 55 and 64-year-old threshold that will now be subject to work requirements, but also had some advice to help people.
The other thing that we want people to know is that caregiving is something you can include as part of working. So if you're going to school, you know, working part-time or a caregiver, those could potentially qualify as part of one of those requirements. So caregiving is an important part of what a lot of people do in caring for their loved ones. So we want to make sure people know that they can consider that as well and should apply with that in mind.
So that's for people who maybe fall into that age range that have, like, you know, like an aging parent. But the federal government just actually granted Hawaii an exemption from being subjected to payment errors during the implementation of these work requirements until September 30th, 2026, which just gives the state a little more time to work out how to implement these work requirements. It's not going to stop the state from imposing the requirements because they have to make a good faith effort to get this exemption, but it means that the state won't be penalized for having an error rate over 6%, which can be very, very costly.
All right, so we get a little bit of a break. But thanks so much, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been hearing from HR's Ashley Mazul, who will be covering the governor's news conference at noon. Look for her coverage on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Live from the Atherton presents Celebrate 808, a month-long series highlighting the sounds and soul of Hawaii. Every Saturday starting November 8th, we're celebrating local music with HPR's own Bridging the Gap DJs alongside artists Stephen Henderson, Kala'e Parrish, and Isaac. Step into the Atherton. Live, local, and tune in with the 808. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Kim Koko Fund for Justice of the Iwamoto Family Foundation, partnering with Hawaii Ulu Cooperative, local farmers strengthening food security through production methods designed to be environmentally sustainable.
You know, late last year, drama unfolded in New Zealand's parliament after a small group of its members participated in a haka, a traditional Maori dance on the floor. Have a listen.
The house is suspended until the ringing of the bells. The gallery is to be cleared.
You know, that moment was in protest of a bill which sought to redefine New Zealand's founding treaty with the Maori people. The bill was eventually voted down and the treaty still stands. Parliament suspended three of its members who took part in the haka protest, including Debbie Nadiwa Packer, the co-leader of the Maori Party. Packer is in town to give a talk at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus tonight. She stopped by our studios yesterday to talk with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson. She begins by describing the goals of the Maori Party.
I mean, we're the only Indigenous party in Aotearoa, so we are really proud of our approach of being unapologetically Māori. But more significantly, we were one of the last nations colonised. We have a treaty of Waitangi, which was a blueprint of how to live in harmony with First Nations peoples and the settlers. And so our party is very much about promoting that as a way of a future, to be able to live with dignity, address, obviously, inequities, but find more progressive ways of being able to live in a nation that deserves to be so much more than just taken over by a whole bunch of capitalists.
I want to hear your thoughts on Prime Minister Christopher Luxon's Conservative government. Are you seeing parallels there with our government here in the Trump administration?
Absolutely. We are a reflection of Trump, and I guess probably one of the most disturbing things is to have that type of politics come to our oceans. You know, we're a nation that's been really proud of women's vote and been proud of being anti-nuclear, been proud of being anti-apartheid, and, you know, really punching above our weight in progressive things that are about peace and parihaka, for example. And so to see the gumboots of Trump's behaviour, where, you know, things are about rage baiting and highlighting the differences and attacking those who are struggling, attacking immigrants, attacking, you know, Indigenous peoples, rainbow, woman, I mean, disabled, it's not a way that anyone can walk around with their heads high and proud. So, you know, it is a moment in time. I guess the difference is that as Indigenous people, we're forever people. So we have to have that forever tolerance and that forever patience and that forever love to help our nation navigate away from that narrative. And it's really tough.
Well, and how do you respond? I mean, you talked about how to respond with character. How do you respond politically? How is the Maori Party responding politically?
Yeah, I think, I mean, so politically, one of the things we do, which just creates so much horror and shock for this, you know, right-wing government, is we be who we are. And I think that's my encouragement to everybody, you know, be your authentic self. And for us, that is asserting our culture when something is just so revoltingly divisive and attacking, you know, the very essence of who we are, as we saw with the Treaty Principles Bill, we'll stand up and haka in the House, and we will stand up so the world can see that our youngest MP, who is only 22 at the time, will be the mouthpiece and speak our ancestral tongue to show a way forward. Politics is a lot of debate, and you've got to have the great policies, and you've got to have the things that represent your values. But the other thing is about this is extremely theatrical. And we have to use our 5 minutes of influence in that House to speak, to show the world that this isn't who we are. We're so much better and bigger than this. And so, you know, we are really deliberate and intentional with our sphere of influence as Māori politicians. And I think that's some of the examples. You know, we've seen something go viral for billions. You know, the behind-the-scenes stuff is a fact of the matter is that the person who was meant to start the haka, one of our MPs, missed his flight. And so, you know, We've got a gallery full of those who own that haka. We've got cameras in our face, the fact that they could count every nostril, every hair nostril. But the reality is that we had to lean in and trust that, as none of us knew the beginning of the haka, our youngest 22-year-old made up a statement, which if you listen to what she said, kawana, actually what she was reminding them of. You are here by right of the Treaty of Waitangi. You are here because of the love of my ancestors for your ancestors. Behave.
Kawana, hapakamanu firiti akoe.
Young Hannah made that up because she got the last minute nod from us. You're going to have to start the haka. Oh, but I can't fight. You're going to have to because I'm doing the point of order and Rawiri's doing the speech and Mari Meno has to stay here in case we get kicked out. That's the leaning in and showing who Te Pāti Māori's authentic self is from the youngest voice.
Yeah, and this moment you're describing where the haka was done on the parliamentary floor there did in fact go viral. But for those unfamiliar, give us some context for the haka and some point of origin.
Yeah. I mean, so here we are with a government that is saying to us, we want to rip up your treaty and the treaty of partnership and the treaty of love of, you know, an Indigenous people with the settlers. And when you look at Hana, she was ripping, and we'd actually had orchestrated ripping that piece of paper on purpose because the bill was 2 pages. A bill that was going to wipe out our rights and our dignity and our existence was barely, you know, 2 pages. It couldn't even dignify us with pretending to put a whole lot of thought into it. And so the haka is something that you would probably have internationally have seen on the rugby field, at graduations, actually even at funerals. And what it is our assertion of emotion, our assertion of existence. We reach into our ancestors, and it is a motivation to call us together and to take it on. But the essence of haka is actually how we debate and show ourselves and ready for the battle. And it is an extremely mana, proud, enhancing, respectful thing.
And the treaty that you refer to, the Treaty of Waitangi, give us a sense of even just timeline and exactly what they were trying to do with that 2-page bill.
Sure, yeah. So the Treaty of Waitangi, or the Te Tiriti of Waitangi, is a document that was signed between the chiefs of the hapū of Māori in Aotearoa with the government, Queen Victoria at the time, 1840, 6th of February. And so the essence of the treaty was to respect the sovereignty of Māori and its existing rights, and then establish a sovereignty under the Queen of her citizens who are arriving. Obviously, the context of that was that the land developers, you know, ring a bell, the property developers were arriving and slicing up tribal land, and then they became lawmakers, and there's a whole history to what went down in that period. And so the treaty bill came in with this government and made up of a very small minority parties. I think Axelit barely got 8%. And their whole gist as a coalition was to support each other's views. ACT wanted to have a bill that would replace or get rid of the treaty and its principles and all the legislation that exists in Aotearoa, which is about the preservation of our language, the respect of Māori sovereignty, and also, most significantly, restoring what colonisation did when the treaty was disrespected. So to have something like that come into the House in 2024 was really confronting. It created the largest hikoi that the country's ever known, which was joined with by the Māori Queen. And as a consequence that, we had the community on the ground activate and then participate in the submission phases of parliamentary process. So 389,000 submissions, the largest the country's ever had, opposed and wrote in opposition to it. And it broke the parliamentary website system. 98% opposed it. And by the second reading, it got voted down. But there was a time when we were extremely concerned that National, if it got the support and it got the, hey, let's go ahead, green flag, would go with ACT. So at no stage could New Zealand and New Zealanders let this go past. And what we saw was a stand-up of not just Māori, a whole lot of non-Māori who we call tangata tiriti, who lived in Aotearoa by rights of the treaty and have equal rights as Māori. And so we had, I think it's Asians in opposition to the bill, and we had Pacifica Nations and a whole lot of tangata tiriti. We had unions And it was, you know, one of the biggest times that we've had multiple sectors of our country unite in opposition. So it was, yeah, powerful. So the last thing we could do was sit in Parliament. I mean, the bill came in and just sort of go, no, six opposed. So, you know, you can sort of see the responsibility on us to make sure the world knew that we would never, ever support a government trying to erase our treaty.
And so many of those puzzle pieces that you describe there in terms of sovereign people, land developers coming to town, a small group of individuals trying to control the will of whole peoples, sounds very familiar.
Everything is parallel. I mean, when the renaissance of the language here, of Kanaka Māori language was happening, Māori came over to share what our experiences was. Our whole opposition to the militarization of the Pacific, our whole opposition to the fact that we don't need to be going down a line where, you know, 2%, New Zealand own more than 50% of the world. You're going to forever have the property developers that arrived here in 1840 commanding the economy, and those who are struggling, working hard on the front line even during COVID, and being left behind. And so I guess what Indigenous peoples threaten is, you know, we're the last bastion to protecting our environment. I've been very active in the seabed mining opposition. But we also are there to remind that our ancestors wanted everyone here to live equally with dignity. We're not rich envy. We just want everyone to be given a fair chance. I mean, you've got a tax system that's been designed by politicians and property developers from way back in the 1800s. We're going to end up where we are now in 2025 with a stressed planet, stressed humans, and the elite being able to get away with doing what they're doing. I do see that in Hawaii, but I also see real hope where the Forever People and the allies of Forever People working together and working together more, and they are getting in places of legislation, places of influence, and they're growing their children to know what's right by everybody and be more humanity-focused.
And this point you've made now a couple of times about larger coalitions coming together, that to me is important because so often politics are framed in sort of left-right terms, right? Conservative and liberal. But what you're pointing out is it really is much more of a vertical conversation, right? And an economic conversation, a conversation about capitalism.
Yeah, it is. I mean, let's be honest. You've got a president, this is really interesting, who is married to an immigrant who sits there and tries to appeal to the hardworking people who has never known a struggle in his life. He's a zillionaire. I've got a prime minister who has never known hardship in his life. He is, a zillionaire who happens to have property here in Hawaii. And they're trying to tell us that, trust us, we will deal with the cost of living crisis in New Zealand. It's like, no, neither of you are fit to understand what it is to come from collective communities where we love our children, we grow them up, we want them to have the best education, the best health system, the best opportunities at whatever they want to do in jobs or self-employment or arts, whatever. And what you're doing is you're using our language, you're rage baiting against us, and we all think, oh, he's an ordinary, decent human being. He understands the struggle of the real people on the ground, but actually has never lived it. We need solutions that are going to flip everything upside down, less extractive industries, less industries that look after the bloated shareholders, and more industries that talk about renewable energy. What on earth do we need to do now to invest in that? How can every New Zealander afford energy? Because we have an equity energy crisis. How is it that we have the largest supplier of milk and primary sector and dairy, and our people can't afford to buy cheese and milk from the very land that they live off? So, yeah, and that is about challenging the capitalists and the economy. And, you know, Indigenous people threaten the Trumps and the Chris Luxons and the right wing. And, you know, every day I read something about myself in the newspaper that they've attacked and they've rage baited and, you know, these Maoris, you know, they're radicals, they're going to kill us in our beds, they don't want to, you know, to care about anything else. Rubbish. During COVID, who was looking after everybody? It was Māori and Pacifica. You know, who was using their own resources to keep people at home safe and make sure they got food and they got the kind of support that they needed when their own families went around them? And I think that's, you know, that's the story, but it's really hard to rise above the noise. And I think, you know, we've just got to continue to be Forever People and just show action and show action with lots of aloha.
So you're here in Hawaii and you have a very packed schedule. Tell us about the talk you'll be giving.
Yeah, so I've been really honoured to be invited and being able to come here to school, and obviously went to Maui and had a look at
Lahaina.
Thank you, Lahaina. The theme has been understanding the issues that we're up against. We've got some extreme politics going on. And the extremism of that, and I will say white supremacy is really rampant in Aotearoa at the moment. And then we've got extreme conditions where we've seen a fire that got out of control, and schools and communities where there's been a loss of native language. And yet the resilience and the tenacity and the absolute endearingness to sort of get up and push back against all of this negativity. And so it's been really nourishing for me. But it's actually, I guess, the better talks and the conversation about us as leadership is, you know, what is the type of leadership we should be encouraging, sharing, nurturing in these times? You know, our ancestors left not breadcrumbs, they left bread factories of signs of what we should do in challenging periods. And most significantly, how we should do it. And that is about tapering our patience and anger and frustrations that perhaps is the forever people. Not everything's going to be done today. But what we can do is continue to grow great leadership, integral leadership, and encourage that leadership to be innovative and authentic, which is what we hoped the haka showed to do. So I think it's going to take some extreme, well-balanced leadership and leaders to navigate us to a place where we can all live balanced.
That was Debbie Nadiwa Packer talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson. Tonight, her talk will address Indigenous politics in an age of peril. It takes place at 6:30 in the Arts Building Auditorium on the UH Manoa campus. It is part of the Better Tomorrow Speaker Series. We'll have details on our website after the show. Home at last. After more than a century, cultural artifacts from Guam and the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands have been returned to their home islands. A ceremony was held in Guam on Friday to mark the event. 2 months ago, HPR was there when Bishop Museum held a ceremony to announce that it agreed to return some 10,000 artifacts. The items in its collection over the decades included iwi, or full skeletal remains, as well as pottery shards. Hawaii quietly returned the iwi earlier, but on a Saturday in August, dignitaries here in Honolulu gathered to pay their respects, to acknowledge the large limestones, the lattice stones, that in the Chamorro culture, islanders used to build their kanuhales and other structures. On.
I lift up my eyes to the mountain. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. Dios.
Building thatch huts on the lattice stone structures is not something you see in Polynesia or Micronesia. It was a practice in Guam among the Chamorros that ended with the Spanish colonization. The lattice stones were part of the Hans Hornsbostel collection. He was a former Navy man whose archaeological collection ended up at the Bishop Museum. Here's Guam Lieutenant Governor Josh Tenorio speaking at the August ceremony, explaining what this ethical return means to the Chamorros of Guam and CNMI.
Prepara Hamzu, Tauto Guam and Marianas, Man Manyasaga Guini Gi Hawaii, Especiat Menti Todu Hamzu, in Nais Bishu para imilitat zani. It is with esteemed honor that I speak on behalf of Governor Leon Guerrero and the people of Guam today. For today's ceremony, as we begin the process to return the more than 10,000 Chamorro cultural artifacts, Chamorro and Carolinian artifacts, as I discovered yesterday, back to Guahan and all of the islands of the Marianas. This effort is the product of a long-term cooperative partnership between the Department of Chamorro Affairs in Guam and the Bishop Museum to right the wrongful removal of the artifacts and human remains from the Mariana Islands over a century ago. Today's ceremony is not simply to start the process of return, but to earnestly begin the process of rematriation of artifacts to their rightful homelands and their indigenous Chamorro and Carolinian communities. Rematriation, as opposed to repatriation, is focused on restoring the relationship between an indigenous people and the culture and land of their ancestors. Today, we honor and celebrate this collective understanding and the shared values of both the native Chamorro, the Carolinian, and the Kanaka Maoli communities. The return of these artifacts is in the midst of an era of cultural preservation and revitalization on the island of Guam. Our people have been embarking on a journey over the last few decades towards both a reclamation and an appreciation of our unique cultural heritage and our language. Such an endeavor requires strategic action towards the reframing of our people's connection to our lands and waters against the backdrop of a colonial history and the present day challenges we face as an unincorporated territory. Reclamation provides a path forward for the people of Guam to strive towards cultural resiliency and sovereignty, which are essential tenets recognized as rights of the indigenous people. The reclamation of the people of Guam's unique cultural identity is a continuous one that can only be accomplished through a multi-pronged approach, bridging public, private, and community-based entities, which will enhance both learning and accessibility. As we reflect on this momentous occasion and the promise through which the return of these artifacts will bring to the island of Guam and her people, we must discover and discuss and acknowledge the actions taken which resulted in their removal from the Mariana Islands. The infamous removal of these artifacts and the set of lati before us by Hans Hornbostel were emblematic of the policies and violations leveled against the indigenous Chamorro at a very different time, which disregarded the sanctity and sacredness of the artifact's original placement by our ancestors. This issue is not unique to just the indigenous Chamorro people of the Marianas, but has regrettably affected indigenous communities across the globe, especially here in the Pacific. However, in the present day, intergovernmental arrangements and partnerships are serving as necessary solutions to right such historical wrongs. The partnership between the Bishop Museum and the government of Guam is symbolic of our resistance and our unrelenting pursuit of dignity for our people. As we prepare to send these sacred artifacts back home to the Marianas, I'm deeply moved by how meaningful this moment is for the Chamorro people. These pieces are more than just objects. They are a physical manifestation of the connection we hold to our ancestral lands and our culture. As a window to the past, I think about what life was like thousands of years ago for Chamorros, how they sailed across the vast ocean and forged connections with other Pacific peoples. That journey continues today as we not only reconnect with our past, but renew and strengthen the bonds of friendship, trust, and mutual respect between the Kanaka Maoli and the Chamorro people. The rematriation of artifacts spearheaded by the Bishop Museum and government of Guam is firmly rooted in indigenous solidarity and recognition of the shared struggles caused by colonization. It is heartening to see this initiative led by the shared values of Hawaiian and Chamorro. I would like to extend my heartfelt appreciation to the Bishop Museum for invoking the principles of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, recognizing and affirming the dignity and rights of Pacific peoples. The partnership embodies the kinship of the Pacific, and I look forward to seeing how it will flourish. I would also like to acknowledge our partners in the United States Navy, who have committed to facilitating the safe return of these artifacts, these latis, back to the Marianas. Yet, as we express gratitude, I would be remiss not to acknowledge history. It is a painful truth that the U.S. Navy played a role in the removal of over 10,000 of these 10,000 cultural artifacts associated with the Hornbostel collection. While confronting the past is uncomfortable, we must come to terms with it. It is my hope, and actually it is my confidence that the Navy's assistance in this process marks a new beginning, one of genuine accountability, reconciliation, and sustained action. Let us not see this as a closure, but as the beginning of an ongoing collaboration and of healing. Proud to stand before you today as we commemorate this history and take a profound step towards reconciliation. This moment is not only the culmination of a